First this morning, a number 8639, Burlington Northern Railroad Company versus the Brotherhood of Maintenance of Way Employees. Mr. Lee, you may proceed whenever you're...
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. One of the prominent features of our federal labor laws is that Congress has singled out two industries, the railroads and the airlines, for special treatment under their own statute, the Railway Labor Act, which differs both in its substance and also in the way it is administered from the National Labor Relations Act. Those differences are designed to make railway and airline work stoppages more difficult and therefore less likely, reflecting a congressional judgment that these two industries are particularly strike-sensitive and that the public has much to lose if strikes should occur in those industries. Indeed, this Court has pointed out several times that the principal purpose of the Railway Labor Act, described in Section 2 and Section 2 first, is to minimize the likelihood of railway and airline strikes. The Act has been largely successful in achieving that purpose. The question presented in this case is whether Congress nonetheless intended that these two industries would be the only ones powerless against secondary picketing, which is the single device most likely to result in nationally paralyzing strikes. The holding that we seek is a narrow one. It is simply that there are some circumstances in which federal courts can enjoin secondary picketing of railroads. The Court need not decide, and we're not asking the Court to decide, whether all secondary picketing of railroads is enjoinable. Given the facts of this case, where the labor dispute is confined, in the Court of Appeals' words, to a tiny railroad in New England, where the picketing occurred in Los Angeles against a railroad that does not operate within 1,000 miles of New England, and where the purpose of the picketing was, again in the Court of Appeals' words, to shut down the nation's entire railroad system, affirmance of the Court of Appeals' judgment will require the Court to hold that under no circumstances, regardless of how remote the connection between the labor dispute and the pressure point, and regardless of how great the damage to the national interest, no court may ever enjoin the picketing of a neutral railroad employer who is a powerless victim in someone else's labor dispute.
And you suggest that there are circumstances, and this is one of them.
That is correct.
And how do you distinguish in terms of Norris LaGuardia those cases where an injunction is all right and those that are not?
Well, we think that the dividing point is the distinction between secondary picketing and primary activity. The same distinction that is drawn in the federal labor laws generally in other contexts. And we think that that follows from...
Well, I thought you said that there some secondary, truly secondary picketing would be permissible and some not.
That is correct. Those instances, what is required is the extent of the alignment between the secondary picketing victim, the extent to which that victim has in fact identified itself on the side of the primary.
So
employer.
You say that, so it's got to do with whether there's a labor dispute.
Well, whether there is a labor dispute
between the object of the picketing and.
Yes, and indeed, in any instance, what we're saying is that there are some instances in which courts do have the injunction power.
You just say it's not, this just doesn't arise out of a labor dispute. Picketing in Los Angeles just doesn't arise out of a labor dispute.
Is that
your argument?
That is one part of the argument. The heart of our argument is that since that kind of activity, picking Los Angeles against a railroad dispute in Maine, is protected by the Railway Labor Act. That kind of picketing is a violation of the Railway Labor Act. And since this court...
Because
the Railway Labor Act was intended, Justice White, to prohibit those activities which violate not only its express terms, but also those principles that the courts would derive from its policies. And that clearly was the purpose of the Railway Labor Act as prescribed.
Well, on that basis, all secondary picketing should be banned.
Well.
Under the Railroad Labor Act.
All I'm saying is this. In exercise any kind of injunctive remedy, the court always has to look to the particular circumstances to determine whether an injunction is proper or not. And all I'm really saying is that the fact that the Railway Labor Act does not, in its terms, deal with secondary picketing does not mean that the courts do not have their usual injunctive powers where there has been a violation of the Railway Labor Act, and it's to that issue that I now turn. It really turns on the view that you take of what kind of statute this Railway Labor Act is. The key to the Court of Appeals' error, in our view, was its holding that the Railway Labor Act is not a statute establishing rules, but is rather, in the Court of Appeals' words, a statute establishing goals and calling on the judiciary to create the rules. In other words, it is not a statute like the Sherman Act, in which the general principles were set forth, and then the courts would be, in anticipation, the courts would be called on to develop the details. That premise lies at the very heart of the Court of Appeals' rationale and its holding, and it is just flat wrong. The principal draftsman of the Railway Labor Act was a union lawyer, Mr. Donald Richburg, who described for Congress the general purpose of the statute, and that description was set forth by this Court in its Chicago and Northwestern opinion, and because it does really go to the heart of the case, with the Court's indulgence, I will read this brief statement. We believe, and this law has been written upon the theory that, there is more danger in attempting to write specific provisions and penalties into the law than there is in writing the general duties and obligations into the law, and then letting the enforcement of those duties and obligations develop through the courts in the way in which the common law has developed in England and America.
Well, Mr. Lee, precisely what do we look at in the Railway Labor Act to find unlawful this secondary picketing? Where do we look? Where is it, and what is it?
Section 2 first.
I think you got it back.
And Section 2 first prescribes that the parties shall do everything in their power to make and maintain agreements in such a way as to minimize the interruption to interstate commerce. Now, how much mileage can you get out of that language, and to what extent can we derive specific rules from the general provisions of, from those more general provisions of the Railway Labor Act? Let me give you just briefly three instances in which this Court has done just exactly that, and we think that the inference that we're asking from the general policy, the most important of the Act's policies, which was to avoid interruption to interstate commerce, is not anything more radical than what this Court has done in those three cases.
You don't think that if Congress had intended to make secondary picketing unlawful at the time that it wrote the Railway Labor Act, that it would have said it was?
No, it would not, for two reasons, Justice O'Connor. One is that it was universally assumed, and the Court of Appeals agrees with us on this point, that in 1926, when the Railway Labor Act was adopted, secondary picketing was universally condemned. There is simply no reason to assume that in a statute such as this one, which sets out the general rules and then leaves it to the courts to fill in the details, to assume that Congress would have made any assumption other than that secondary picketing was unlawful at the time.
And
the
you say, Mr., that loosely speaking, the Railway Labor Act is like the Sherman Act, in that it sets general goals and lets the courts work out the methods of reaching them rather than a detailed statute.
That is absolutely right. That is absolutely right. And that is the, lies at the heart of the Court of Appeals' error. The three cases that I'd like to point out in which the Court has done just exactly that can be very briefly summarized. The first one is the Chicago River case, which in 1957 upheld an order enjoining the union, notwithstanding the Nogales-LaGuardia Act, enjoining the union from striking over minor disputes which were then pending before the National Railroad Adjustment Board, which is the entity that, that resolves these minor disputes. The Railway Labor Act does not expressly prohibit that kind of a strike, any more than in this case it expressly prohibits secondary picketing. But the Court nevertheless upheld the injunction because the strike, the Court found, was inconsistent with the purposes and the structure of the Act. And the same rule applies with respect to major disputes.
Yes, but
in the Supreme Court?
I know, but where, what was it, a minor dispute?
It was a minor dispute, and it was pending before the National
Railroad. Well, any kind of a minor dispute goes to the Railway Labor Board, doesn't it?
That is correct. But the question was whether the Railway Labor Act prohibits strikes There is nothing in the statute that says, that deals with that one way or the other. It was left to this court to fill in the details.
Yes, but Mr. Lee, isn't there a difference that in that case, the Railway Labor Act expressly made the union subject to the obligation to grieve the minor dispute? And there's no such express requirement with regard to secondary picketing.
Justice Stevens, I'm glad you asked that question, because I'm going to tell you that if you read that opinion carefully, you will see that there were two things that the court reread into that issue in the Chicago River case. The first was that there was the obligation of compulsory arbitration. That in itself had to be inferred from the general purposes of the Act. So that there was actually in the Chicago River case, as I read it, and I'm confident my reading is correct, a double inference that had to be drawn. So I think that distinction did not exist in the Chicago River case.
But the express language of Section 2 first says it's the duty of the carriers to
that is correct.
And resolve
the first thing that, and actually the court devotes several pages to this. The first thing that the court had to determine was whether that meant compulsory arbitration. Now, to be sure, there isn't quite the level of inference that we're asking you to draw here.
Yeah.
But there was, in that case, really an inference on an inference. And it said nothing about strikes. And that was...
Well, I understand the strikes, and the same here, nothing about strikes, but the basic prohibition against the secondary picketing, you infer from 152, you really have argued kind of two ways in your briefs. Part of the time you argue it's based on 152, and part of the time you argue it's based on these old Sherman Act cases that were sort of a predicate for the legislation, and that was the source
of prohibition. Yes, yes. And I think that's really two parts of one argument. It is on Section 152, but that in turn is influenced by what the state of the law was in 1926 when the Railway Labor Act was adopted. Now, turning to major disputes, just very briefly, I'd like to point out two cases that we think are relevant to this very point. The first is the Florida East Coast case. That one did not involve an injunction, but it did squarely hold that even after the formal statutory processes for resolving major disputes have been exhausted, that the RLA still imposes limits on the party's rights of self-help after that point in time, which is squarely inconsistent with what the Court of Appeals held. And it holds that those are to be found not in the RLA's express terms, because there are no express terms dealing with that, but rather from its purposes. And finally, in the Chicago and Northwest case, the one from which Mr. Richburg's quote is taken, the court in 1971 held that the courts can enjoin a strike instituted after the major dispute resolution procedures have been exhausted, where the conduct of the union, in that case it was a refusal to bargain in good faith, violated the purposes of the very section we're relying on, Section 2 first, which requires the parties to make every reasonable effort to avoid interruptions to interstate commerce. Now, in all three cases, strikes over minor disputes in Chicago River, determination of the limits on the parties' self-help rights following exhaustion of the major dispute resolution procedures in Florida East Coast, and the refusal to bargain after exhaustion of those same procedures in Chicago and Northwestern, the relevant RLA principles were found not in the terms of the Act, but in its purposes.
Mr. Lee, you didn't mention Jacksonville Terminal, and of course in that case, although it had to do with state court enforcement, the rationale of the court, as expressed, was that neither the common law nor the NLRA provided sufficient guidance to determine the scope of permissible picketing under the Railway Labor Act. The reasoning of the court kind of cuts against your argument here, I think.
In Jacksonville?
Yes.
We think not. The opinion, as my friend Mr. Clark will surely remind you when it comes to his term, is that it can be read in two ways. But we think that two things I think are unavoidable. One is that the holding of the case reaches only the preemption issue. We're not dealing there with the reach of the Railway Labor Act. You're dealing only with the issue of whether state law could apply. And the second is, if you look to what the court said with respect to the Railway Labor Act, and it appears on page 390, I submit that Jacksonville Terminal not only is not inconsistent with Chicago River, Chicago Northwest, and Florida East Coast, but indeed that it actually supports our position. And I'm reading from page 390, and the relevant language is this. The Railway Labor Act, drawing upon labor policies evinced by the National Labor Relations Act, and Chastanville does stand for the proposition that that is proper, cannot categorically be said that all picketing carrying secondary implications is prohibited. That's all we're asking in this case, and we think that that language from Jacksonville Terminal is controlling. It cannot categorically be said, the court said, that the RLA prohibits all secondary picketing, but that's not the issue here. If the case is strong enough, as it certainly is in this case, then the courts ought to be able to prohibit secondary picketing. The issue here is whether, under the RLA, any secondary picketing is unlawful. And the narrow holding, the only one that we see, is that our national labor laws, the Railway Labor Act, accommodated with Norris LaGuardia, and influenced by the National Labor Relations Act, prohibits or permits some protection against secondary picketing.
Well, then, if we answer that question yes in your favor, is it your idea that the lower courts would work out kind of on an ad hoc basis? There certainly wouldn't be many, many guidelines, would there?
Neither would there be many cases, Justice, Mr. Chief Justice. I think there would be guidelines, because the court said in Jacksonville Terminal that you draw from the body of labor policy, particularly the National Labor Relations Act, and that would provide a...
Yes, but you make a point of that this picketing was in Los Angeles and the dispute was in Maine. But, you know, if you have a dispute in Boston, if you have the picketing in Boston, it would be a rather strange doctrine that said, you know, secondary picketing in Los Angeles can be enjoined when the railroad is in Maine, but secondary picketing in Boston can't be.
Yes. Two things. One is, of course, we want to win this case on this case's facts. But I think I agree with you, and I think this is probably Justice White's point that he was making earlier as well, that the principle probably is going to extend to most secondary picketing. But fortunately, the facts of this case demonstrate how extreme the situation can be.
Suppose it was perfectly clear from the Railroad Labor Act that as far as that act was concerned, it neither prohibited secondary picketing nor permitted it. Would the Norris LaGuardia Act prohibit the injunction then?
We think not, because you mean either under its terms or as influenced by its policies.
Well, just say the Railway Labor Act said we do not intend to prohibit secondary picketing. That's what it said. And then along came the Norris LaGuardia Act.
Then I think our case would be much more difficult. It would not be totally abandoned, because under the Eighth Circuit's opinion, and there is a portion of our brief that is devoted to this, it would leave us to the question of whether the Eighth Circuit's opinion naturally drew.
Let's assume, though, that the Norris LaGuardia Act would, on my supposition, prohibit the injunction.
Yes.
Now, and then the Railway Labor Act is amended to say that secondary picketing is prohibited. Now, does that... what do you say about the Norris LaGuardia Act then? Do you say it's been partially repealed? What do you say?
No. I said that is a very easy case for me at that point, because this court has said in Chicago River and in Chicago and Northwest very plainly that where you have that circumstance, yeah, you accommodate the two, and that unlike other statutes, unlike other non-labor statutes, that the accommodation means that Norris LaGuardia does not prohibit enjoining activity which violates the Railway Labor Act.
So the usual rule about partial repeal just isn't applicable in the sense
we don't
that
it
ought to be really clear. You shouldn't just have to infer it.
That is correct. Now, in this case, fortunately for us, the RLA came before Norris LaGuardia, so there isn't that matter. But even so, the approach that this Court has taken in those two cases is not one of partial repeal.
Well, I would think the argument would be under Norris LaGuardia, since the Railway Labor Act was was prior there too, that you could say the prior, whatever was true under the Railroad Labor Act before that, the Norris LaGuardia was intended to prevent an injunction.
Yes. But our view is, and this is certainly, if that principle applied without any accommodation, then you have to overrule at least Chicago River and Chicago Northwestern, in both of which cases injunctions were upheld solely in activity arising out of a labor dispute, solely on the ground that the substantive activity was a violation of the Railway Labor Act. What we are really asking for is simply this. The Act does not prescribe specifically what happens after the major dispute resolution processes have been exhausted. That is a question whose resolution must be anchored to the purpose of the Act. One aspect of that question has already been answered by this Court by reference to the purpose of the Act. It was the holding very early in the game in Brotherhood of Engineers versus Baltimore and Ohio, in which the Court held that on the union side, though the Railway Labor Act does not explicitly guarantee the right to strike against the primary employer following exhaustion of the negotiation and mediation requirements, there is inferred a right to strike from the Act's failure to provide compulsory arbitration with respect to major disputes. What we are asking for, we think, necessarily follows from this Court's holding that the union can resort to some kinds of self-help following exhaustion of the major dispute resolution procedures. The Second Circuit held just last summer, and frankly, I think probably correctly, that those procedures are not available to employers other than the primary employer. It follows, we submit, that the right of self-help against those other employers is also unavailable, because it is nothing short of preposterous to assume that Congress would have so carefully prescribed protracted procedures which must be exhausted vis-a-vis the primary employer before resort to self-help against that employer is permitted, and then would have permitted unlimited self-help, which at any level against any employer must itself be inferred against carriers who are not even parties to the dispute, employers who the Second Circuit has held cannot invoke the negotiation and mediation strike delaying proceedings and are therefore left without those core protections.
Well, how about railroads interconnecting with this railroad?
Those would be the hard cases, the kinds of cases in which you would have to ask to what extent there is a substantial alignment. Fortunately, in this case, there is no interconnection between any of my clients and either of the struck parties. We think that this case is especially compelling where, as you point out, Justice White, in this instance, self-help against the primary employer will affect none of the carriers that even interconnect with that primary employer. Because whereas the self-help against the primary employer will affect an area limited at most to a few states in New England, the purpose of the picketing against my clients is, as the Court of Appeals conceded, to shut down the nation's entire railroad system. And since that's tantamount to shut down the nation itself, there is simply no reason to assume that Congress intended to have railroad unions to have that long a lever, longer than is available to any other union in the country. Congress gave us a carefully crafted structure for preventing interruptions to railroad service. What it anticipated is that those would be resolved by negotiation, by agreement, and not by self-help. But if unions such as this one know that once they have exhausted the statutory procedures vis-a-vis the primary employer, and they are then free to employ a weapon many times more powerful than a primary strike, a weapon capable of bringing the entire nation to its knees, because the statutory prerequisites to a strike, so carefully prescribed by Congress vis-a-vis the primary employer, are totally unavailable to the union's new victims once it resorts to a nationwide rail stoppage, then the most important purpose of the Railway Labor Act will have been completely perverted. It is small wonder that in the 60 years that we have had the Railway Labor Act, that this is the first instance in which any court has ever upheld, that is, the cases that came down this last summer, any court has ever upheld such picketing. Unless the court has questions, Mr. Chief Justice, I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. We'll hear now from you, Mr. Clark.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. The petitioners in this case center on the 1926 Railway Labor Act as being the focal act in which to examine, to determine whether or not the unions do have a right to ask other railroad employees to help them in their dispute. Now, the unions submit that the appropriate act to look at and to examine is the Norris-LaGuardia Act, the 1932 Act. And before we get into that, it would be helpful, we submit, to go back to the facts in this case to see exactly what is at issue here. This is not a typical or the secondary boycott type of concept that was in existence around the turn of the century. What is involved here is a union going to other railroad employees and asking those employees to help them in their struggle by withholding their labor, because the union believes that by withholding their labor, they will put sufficient pressure on the primary employer to have that primary employer negotiate.
Well, that's a strike, isn't it?
It is. It's a sympathy strike. Now, around the turn of the century, this was looked at as being a sympathy strike, but it also had the elements of what was called at that time a secondary boycott, putting pressure upon a neutral employer to require that employer to stop doing business with the primary employer. There is a distinction in labor law between sympathy strikes and secondary boycotts, which is often overshadowed or messed together. But going to this particular case, what we are dealing with, as we indicated, is simply the request by a union to other employees to withhold their labor. It involves two aspects that are essentially fundamental to everybody, to all individuals, the right of free speech and the right to withhold one's labor. Now, in 1932, Congress enacted an Norris-LaGuardia Act which specifically informed the courts two particular things that are relevant here. First, they told the courts, we don't want you involved in labor disputes in determining what is proper and what is not proper conduct. That's not your function. That's our function, so you stay out of it. Secondly, Congress said, we're going to tell you what is proper conduct. And in Section 4 of the Act, they specifically enumerated several types of conduct, which they said, from now on, as we said in 1914, but no one would listen, and we say again, those types of conducts are conduct that cannot be enjoined.
Now you could accept everything Mr. Lee says about the Railway Labor Act and still conclude that you should win here, that even if this secondary picketing would have violated the Railway Labor Act prior to Norris-LaGuardia, or even now, it can't be enjoined.
Your Honor, that is correct, but we don't accept the fact that the 1926...
Well, I know, but that is that your position or not?
It is. The Norris-LaGuardia controls whether the Railway Labor Act has an implicit ban on secondary picketing, which we submit it does not. But the Norris-LaGuardia Act controls this case. In 1932...
Even if, no matter what the Railway Labor Act says?
Because the Railway Labor Act does not have an explicit prohibition against secondary picketing.
Well, let's assume that it isn't explicit, but let's assume that you would infer it, as Mr. Lee suggests. Then what would you say about Norris-LaGuardia? You say it still controls?
We would submit it still controls because it was the latter statute addressed to a specific problem.
The later statute
addressed to a specific problem, namely what forms of self-help.
What do you do about our later cases?
Yeah, Chicago and Northwestern, Chicago River.
Yes, Your Honor. The Chicago River case was an interpretation of the 1934 amendments, the amendments that occurred 2 years after the Norris-LaGuardia was enacted. And the 1934 amendment was a specific sale, in a sense, by rail labor of its right to strike in exchange for the National Railroad Adjustment Board.
Yeah, but Chicago and Northwestern in 402 U.S., as I read it, is a statement that the railroads had a duty to do something under the Railway Labor Act, They did not do it, and therefore a strike may be enjoined. The court made nothing of the fact that there's no express prohibition against secondary picketing.
But the court did make point of the fact that the Railway Labor Act's heart was the duty to exert every reasonable effort to reach a conclusion, to reach an agreement with the carriers, and that in that case the union was, according to the complaint, simply engaging in perfunctory bargaining where it did not comply with the Act. Now, but we're not at that extreme point that Justice White asks. We're back to this point that the Railway Labor Act does not implicitly or explicitly prohibit secondary picketing. Now, there's the difference between...
Mr. Clark, what has happened in all these 60 years when instances have arisen of attempts to have secondary picketing of railroads?
Secondary picketing of railroads is there's a lot of historical development that has occurred in the past 60 years that the Railway Labor Act has been in existence. When you go back to the actual reports of the National Mediation Board, what is shown is that between 1926, when the Act was enacted, and World War II, there were very few strikes. There were approximately 3 strikes during that time period. And that from 1940, during World War II up until shortly after that, around 1946, the unions still tried to restrain from striking, but there were a few cases where they weren't going to engage in strikes, and Congress, the President first tried to draft the people, and then Congress was considering enacting legislation. So the need for the full development or the need for the full use of the economic power of the unions did not occur during this time period. But what also occurred during this time period was the multiple bargaining type, what's called national handling in the rail industry, that the unions negotiated nationally with all of the railroads in groups for wages and other factors that occurred during the 30s. So when a strike occurred, it was a strike against everybody. Now, that to say that because in the past there hasn't been this secondary picketing means that there is no such right as secondary picketing is an attempt to use the gloss of today's experience to interpret what was in existence back at that time period, which just can't be done. And the first, when you finally got to the breaking of the national handling, individual strikes around the Florida East Coast time, secondary picketing was used. But the courts at that point stepped right into the fracas and enjoined it. Now, fortunately, the Fifth Circuit in the 1966 Florida's Atlantic Coastline case set aside the injunction, but the state courts entered the void that the federal courts had left and enjoined the secondary activity. The next real strike where this occurred was the 1978 strike. And again, it was the courts that entered, and eventually, after about 2 months, they broke the injunctions loose, but for 2 months, the unions were enjoined from engaging in their full economic power. And then the next strike was the one we're dealing with now.
What did the injunction prohibit here?
The injunction prohibited the Brotherhood of Maintenance of Way from placing pickets near the facilities of the carriers involved in this case, the 8 carriers, to ask their employees to withhold their labor. It also prohibited the employees of those carriers from withholding their labor. So it was the injunction prohibited 2 forms, the speech, namely placing the pickets, and secondly, the withholding of labor. They prohibited the withholding of labor. That's what was enjoined in this case. And the union, in a sense, called for a sympathy strike, and the court said we could not. And that was the injunction that was in place for approximately 40 days with various injunctions. And in the meantime, the Act, which was set up by agreement of the parties back in 1926, and this is why we say the 1926 Act cannot have this effect of outlawing secondary picketing that the petitioners say, is because it was an agreement between the union and the management.
Well, what was the prevailing rule at that time before the Act about the enjoinability of secondary picketing?
Secondary activity was enjoinable, but primary activity.
It was illegal.
It was
to be illegal.
The court,
it was enjoinable.
Yes, Your Honor. The courts considered it enjoinable.
And you think the Railway Labor Act intended to change that rule?
No, Your Honor. That's the point we're trying to make. The Railway Labor Act did not touch what occurs once the Act's processes were exhausted. What the Railway Labor Act was a union and the management and labor getting together and working out a process that would make the need to engage in self-help academic.
I understand. But
the Act did not touch what
the law. The existing law was that secondary picketing was not enjoinable no matter when it occurred prior to the Railway Labor Act.
Prior to the Railway Labor Act, the law was that secondary picketing was enjoinable.
Exactly.
The primary
wasn't it enjoinable afterwards?
It was not enjoinable afterwards because of the 1932 Norris LaGuardia Act.
Well, I know, but between 26 and 32, it was enjoinable.
We submit it was enjoinable for the law that existed prior to that time. But primary strikes were enjoinable prior to that time, the shopman strike and the switchman strike that occurred in 1920 and 1922. In those two strikes, the government went in because of the interference with interstate commerce and obtained injunctions against those strikes.
Well, didn't the Court of Appeals say that the Norris LaGuardia Act prevents this injunction even if the secondary picketing in this case violated the Railway Labor Act?
That is correct, Your Honor. And
do you defend that?
Yes, Your Honor, we do.
All right.
And we defend that on this ground. The Norris LaGuardia Act cannot be read in a vacuum. And the Railway Labor Act cannot be read in a vacuum. The two had to be read together. But the policies expressed by the Norris LaGuardia Act control.
But that's contrary to the holding of the court in the Northwestern case.
We submit it as not, Your Honor, because in the Northwest case, you had a specific requirement in the Act that was not being complied with. And the requirement in the Act that was not being complied with was the duty to exert every reasonable effort to reach an agreement.
So the union was violating the Railway Labor Act. It called a strike, and the strike was enjoined, and this court upheld the injunction.
That's correct, Your Honor, because the specific command of the Railway Labor Act was not followed. Now, the difference between that type of situation and what we're dealing with here is that in order to uphold the petitioners in this case, and in order to enjoin the type of activity involved here, the courts will have to develop what type of conduct is permissible and what type of conduct is not permissible, where there is no specific standard in the Act.
I can see that point, but I thought you were saying that even though there's a violation of the Railway Labor Act here on the part of the union, the Norris LaGuardia Act flatly prohibits any sort of injunction.
That's what you're defending, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor, we are defending
well,
that.
And you say that's consistent with the Northwestern case?
Yes, Your Honor, as long there has to be a violation of a specific.
But you agree if there's a violation of an express prohibition in the Railway Labor Act and a strike, that strike may be enjoined notwithstanding the Norris LaGuardia Act?
Yes, Your Honor. Where there's an express command of the Railway Labor Act, there can be an injunction notwithstanding the Norris LaGuardia Act. Because when the Norris LaGuardia Act was enacted, the legislative history is clear that it was intended to apply before the Norris LaGuardia Act would apply. In other words, what Representative LaGuardia said during the debates, rail labor would not think of going out on strike before they had complied with the Act. Now, if there is a failure to comply with the Act, the court can accommodate the two statutes and enforce the compliance with the Act before the strike can take place. But once there has been compliance with the Act, as there was here, to then come in and say that the Railway Labor Act has some nebulous ban against secondary picketing is to bring the court right back into the fracas that Congress in 1914 and again in 1932 said you're not supposed to be in.
Mr. Clark.
Yes, Your Honor.
Let's move on and assume, for example, you win this case and secondary picketing not only continues to exist but expands so that the railroads are shut down half of the United States. What happens then?
Your Honor, the Act has...
Are the courts powerless then?
Yes, Your Honor. The Act has already built in the standards. And, well, I'm sorry...
So the railroads would stay shut down until Congress acted?
Yes, Your Honor. But, first of all, there's Section 10 in the Act.
2 months?
There's Section 10 in the Act, Your Honor, which allows an immediate cessation of all sorts of self-help, which is what occurred in this case. Then, if that doesn't work, then Congress has the power, as it did in this case, to extend the status quo and finally to impose a solution. That is, in a sense, what this comes down to is that the courts are not the guardian of what is and what is not in the public interest.
Only
that
is Congress. Only with respect to railroads and airlines.
No, Your Honor, with respect to any industry. No industrial management.
But under Taft-Hartley, secondary boycotts are not permitted.
Yes, Your Honor, but the private party cannot come in and get an injunction. The only one who can come to the court to get the injunction is the National Labor Relations Board.
That's by virtue of express congressional consent.
That is correct, Your Honor,
yes,
which we do not have here. So
what is the situation with respect to the trucking companies?
The trucking companies would be the same, Your Honor.
The same as what?
The National Labor Relations Board has to go to the court.
I understand that, but is there anything comparable to Norris LaGuardia with respect to the trucking companies?
Your Honor, the Norris LaGuardia Act still applies to prohibit the individual trucker from going into court to get the injunction. But what is different between the two acts is that the Railway Labor Act has Section 10, which the National Labor Relations Act does not have. Section 10 is the protector of the public interest. It was intended by the drafters of the Act to be the protector of the public interest. And it was the use of Section 10 from 1926 up until the National Mediation Board changed its system in the 1960s that prohibited strikes. Section 10 is what Congress intended to be the guardian of the public interest, not the courts. Now,
But come back to my question. Let's assume, for example, that half the railroads in the United States are shut down by secondary ticketing. Is the only relief Congress?
Yes, Your Honor. If Section 10 had been used.
That could take a certain amount of time, I assume.
It could take a day.
A day?
Or it could take more longer
what
than
is
a day.
It? What is Section 10?
Section 10, Your Honor, is the section which provides that if in the opinion of the National Mediation Board, the strike activity threatens to interfere with the rail transportation in a region of the country, they shall inform the President, who may, in his discretion, create an emergency board. If the emergency board is created, all self-help activity ceases
for a
period of 30 days after the meeting.
This is the cooling off.
Yes, Your Honor. It's normally a 60-day period.
Yes,
vary a little bit.
Yes, I just...
Now,
may I come back again? I'm sorry to keep interrupting you, but it's not yet clear to me. Taft-Hartley applies to every industry in the United States except railroads and airlines.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And so truckers who...
Well, every interstate commerce.
Truckers who compete with railroads are subject to different laws.
That's correct, Your Honor, to the Taft-Hartley Act.
May I ask you one other question, then I'll try to keep quiet. What is your view with respect to the substantial alignment issue? I think I can anticipate it, but I'd like to hear you say it.
We submit, Your Honor, there are no standards in either the Railway Labor Act or the Norris LaGuardia Act that would in any way justify the adoption of a substantial alignment doctrine. The Act specifically says that the courts are to be out of interpreting what is and what is not permissible conduct. And unless there are standards by Congress that the courts are authorized to interpret, as this court said in the Jacksonville Terminal case, the court should not enter this particular area. Now, this brings us the question in this case, and this is why we are not, although we defend and we submit the court is correct, the Court of Appeals was correct, that the Norris LaGuardia Act would control even if there was an implicit ban against secondary picketing in the Railway Labor Act. We submit when you go back to the history and to the facts in this, the development of the Railway Labor Act, that is not so. And as this court held in the Jacksonville Terminal case, there is nothing in the Railway Labor Act which outlaws secondary picketing, secondary activity. The courts in that case, and that was, we submit, the more difficult case and is facing this court today, because the Norris LaGuardia Act did not apply to states, the court had to look in the Jacksonville Terminal case at the body of law, the federal law that existed as to what was and what was not permissible self-help. And it looked to the body of law that had developed under the National Labor Relations Act. Now, in the National Labor Relations Act in 1947, Congress decided that secondary activities should be prohibited. But when it did that, it specifically limited the banning of secondary activities to industries that were covered by the National Labor Relations Act and did not extend it to the railroads. In 1959, Congress extended to the railroads the protection against secondary picketing by non-railroad unions, but again, did not extend the ban against secondary picketing, secondary activity, to the railroads. So what this court faced in the Jacksonville Terminal case was a body of law, a body of labor law, that did say that some forms of secondary picketing were improper, but some forms of secondary conduct were proper. And the court then faced the question, how do we determine which are proper and which are not proper? And it indicated that that was one of the most complex areas of labor law. And
could I ask you, why would you say that non-connecting roads have a dispute with the employer? Or why would you say picketing them arose out of a labor dispute?
Because the only reason the union would engage in picketing of the Burlington Northern or the Western carriers would be to aid its dispute with
the Well, what if they went around and picketed the railroad's customers, the people who were shippers?
At that point, Your Honor, you're outside the industry.
Well, nevertheless, the only reason that you still have a dispute with your own employer and you want to put pressure on them, so you go around and talk to the people in other unions in the grain business or in the wood business and say, stop dealing with this railroad till they topple over. So why wouldn't that be perfectly all right?
Well, we submit it's all right, but that's...
Well, I know, but what would it violate?
It wouldn't
be protected by the Norris LaGuardia Act.
Yes, Your Honor.
Because it doesn't arise out of a labor dispute.
No, it does not arise
but
in
you,
the same industry.
But you can picket a railroad in Los Angeles just because it's a railroad.
No, Your Honor. We can picket a railroad in Los Angeles because the union has determined that it's in its interest to do so. The courts cannot enjoin it because it is in the same industry.
Same industry.
Yes, Your Honor. That's in Section 13B of the National of the.
Well,
National
I know,
Party
but the, why does that arise out of a labor dispute and picketing shippers of logs in Maine does not?
Yeah, it does. The picketing of the shippers of logs in Maine would arise out of a labor dispute.
What?
But it is not the type of conduct that is protected by the Norris LaGuardia Act because it does not pertain to the same industry, which is 13B of the Act.
The Act
requires that it, in order to, who is a person participating or interested in a dispute, it has limitations on it. Those limitations are spelt out in 13A, B, and C. 13B was an adoption of what Professor Frankfurter noted was the New York law, that the picketing of neutral was proper so long as the neutral was in the same industry that the primary disputant was engaged in or the employees were engaged in. Or
what would be the basis for the injunction against picketing the neutral wood shipper?
Your Honor, the second question that comes up, besides the Norris LaGuardia Act issue, is whether there's anything that's wrong about that type of conduct. Now, the typical the basis for an injunction would be that it's a nuisance or that it's an interference with the individual's right to do business. And that raises the question as to whether this is the...
Well, anyway, your argument is that picketing the Los Angeles Railroad is okay, but picketing the log shipper isn't all right.
It is not lawful now unless Congress changes
it. It isn't protected by the Norris LaGuardia.
It's not protected. And it's not protected unless Congress changes the law to allow it to be done. And that is what we're really faced with in this
Mr.
case.
Mr. Clark, let me interrupt you there. I understand your argument that that picketing would not be protected by Norris LaGuardia. But would you say there is any federal prohibition against that picketing?
No, Your Honor.
So that picketing could not be enjoined.
Your Honor, we would submit that it could not be enjoined because it is lawful under the last part of the Clayton Act.
And on that, you don't rely on the Norris LaGuardia Act. It's simply there's an absence of a federal prohibition against it.
That's correct, Your Honor. Well, the question then comes down to
whether about state law.
That's the point that I was getting to. The last clause of the Section 20 of the Clayton Act eliminates all federal law as being this type of conduct as being a violation of. But if Congress specifically limited only to federal law and not to state law. Initially in the House it was, nor shall any of the above acts be considered a violation of any law or shall be considered unlawful. And then it was changed in the Senate and the conference to any law of the United States. So the question, but then the question turns on whether or not that form of conduct is the protected, unregulated activity. And that question turns on whether or not a body of labor law would protect this type of activity. And since the Norris LaGuardia Act is a good indication of what our body of labor law is, especially as pertains to these cases, it would not be protected unregulated activity.
Mr. Clark.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is there a public policy reason to treat railroads differently in this respect from truckers that compete?
Not insofar as what is proper forms of self-help. The public policy considerations are matters that Congress should consider in devising what is proper or what is not proper in self-help, but not for the court's interpretation. And that's the point that we submit the Norris LaGuardia Act was intended to bring home.
Yes, but my question, perhaps I don't understand the situation, is that if a railroad is competing directly with a trucking firm, why should labor law be different with respect to the two? So that you could have an injunction, the NLRB could bring an injunction against a trucker, couldn't it?
Well, Your Honor, the labor law would be different because under the NLRA, it's the NLRB, it's the board that has to come to the court.
I understand.
Here it's the individual carrier that can come to the court and seek the injunction.
Yes.
But that's for the difference is
but,
the fact that the railway labor
can be an injunction in one case but not in the other. That's my point.
Yes, Your Honor, but only at the request of the government. And in the rail case, there can be no injunction. In the trucker case, there can be an injunction, but at the request of the government. That is what Congress set up.
I understand Congress set it up. I was just wondering why they draw the distinction.
Well, the distinction is basically historical, Your Honor. And the distinction is that in 1926, all of the other industries were not covered by any specific legislation fostering collective bargaining. The railroad management and unions got together and presented Congress with a scheme that Congress adopted that fostered collective bargaining, but left wholly silent what occurs once that collective bargaining expires. Now, that's the difference we submit between the distinction on the Florida East Coast case that the carriers rely upon. Florida East Coast was not a case in which the court modified the right of self-help. If anything, the court modified, what the court did was modify the Railway Labor Act. Section 2-7th of the Railway Labor Act prohibits the changing of any collective bargaining provision in a contract except in conformance with Section 6 of the Act, the notice of negotiation. The court indicated and held in the Florida East Coast that section still applied during a strike situation. There was nothing in the Act which indicated that it should expire. But the court said if it applied, it would limit the right of self-help that a carrier has. And therefore, we will read into 2-7th, into the Railway Labor Act, an exception to the full application of 2-7th. And if the carrier can show a court that changes are necessary to in order to enable to continued operations during the strike, then those changes can be made notwithstanding 2-7th of the Act. That's entirely different from what we're talking about here, where the petitioners are trying to say you have to read into the Act some form of modification to the right of self-help, which the Act didn't touch at all.
Could I ask you, what if there had been no picketing, but the head of the union in Los Angeles was a brother of the head of the union in Maine, and he said, well, I just think we ought to help these people out. And he got a lot of other unions. They just walked out on their employers.
Your Honor, the Act...
That's a sympathy strike.
Yes, Your Honor.
Would they have had to go through some procedures before they could strike?
No, Your Honor. If it's in support of another employee strike, which is a lawful strike, if it arises out of the labor dispute, which it would, because they were making common cause to help those people, then it would be under Section 4, it would be part of the specifically enumerated conduct under Section 4, namely Section 4A.
Of the
Norris-LaGuardia Act, which says that
would they have to go through the procedures of the Railroad Labor Act to strike?
No, Your Honor.
Because?
Because it's not, it's a sympathy strike in support of the
and
employees.
And that is expressly excluded from?
Section 4A specifically says that no court may enjoin a refusal to work.
Yeah, now, that's Norris-LaGuardia.
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah, but what about the procedures required by the Railroad Labor Act before you can have strike?
Yes, Your Honor. There is no dispute between the employees in Los Angeles and their carrier that the Railway Labor Act applies to. Mm-hmm. That is not a dispute under the Railway Labor Act. Mm-hmm. It is an action taken in support of a labor dispute in another area. And that is one distinction that has to be kept in mind in considering the Railway Labor Act. The Railway Labor Act is a craft statute. It is one that is made up of different crafts. On the main central area, there are something like 14 different unions. Now, none of those unions had gone through the major dispute processes.
Mr. Clark, your time has expired. Mr. Lee, you have 6 minutes remaining.
Won't need that much, Mr. Chief Justice. Seems to me that the resolution of this case has become very obvious in light of what Mr. Clark has said, stated in about four sequential steps. In 1926, the universal rule was secondary picketing was enjoinable and also, more important for our purposes, unlawful. In that,
Mr. Lee, why is that important for your purposes if you find the prohibition against this activity in the Railway Labor Act? Why is it important that it was enjoinable in 1926?
More important than it was enjoinable is the fact that it was unlawful.
It was unlawful under the Sherman Act, and I don't understand you to be relying on the Sherman Act today.
That is correct. It was universally regarded as simply unlawful under the totality of law. In 1926, in that setting, Congress gave us a law which Congress said was not intended to answer all of the questions, but simply to set forth the general principles and then leave it to the courts to develop as the common law had developed.
But if you're right about that, it doesn't seem to me you need the unlawfulness prior to 1926. It seems to me you just rest on that. That seems to me that's the position you're taking today. I wasn't quite clear on your brief.
I think that's correct. But the fact is it simply strengthens our position that was the assumption that they made in 1926.
Well, they may have made the assumption, but they didn't write it into the law.
That is correct.
But you think they intended that sometime a court could infer that the Act covers it?
What we clearly know, Justice White, we don't know whether they were thinking about secondary picketing. We do know that they said, we don't know all the answers. And because we don't know all the answers, we want this to be the kind of a statute that we set forth the general principles, and then we're going to rely on the courts, just the way the common law has developed, to fill in the responses. And that's exactly what this court has done. Now, if you hold that the Norris-LaGuardia Act prohibits enjoining a violation of the Railway Labor Act, then you've got some cases to overrule, and there is just no question about that. Now, my friend Mr. Clark said, that is to the Chicago and Northwestern case, that there was a violation of a specific provision, which he said was the heart of the Act. He's right on both counts. It was the heart of the Act. The heart of the Act that the court said was violated in that instance was exactly the same provision that we're relying on here, Section 2, first. The specific guarantee, the specific violation, was not written into the Act. It was an obligation to bargain in good faith, and that had to be inferred, from the Act. Now, we come next to the question,
what is the cognate obligation here similar to the one you referred to in Chicago and Northwestern of the union which it violated?
Yes. The cognate obligation is the identical one. The obligation that is written into the statute is to make and maintain agreements in such a way as to minimize the interruptions to interstate commerce. And there is no single practice that is as interruptive of interstate commerce as is this particular practice that we're dealing with here.
If that's correct, supposing you had nationwide bargaining going on, I take it then that even after the exhaustion of the RLA procedures, you'd say there could be no rail strike.
No, not that there could be no rail strike. If it were nationwide, then you
I mean, it seems to me your reasoning leads to the conclusion that because the statute was designed to prevent strikes, and once you exhaust the procedures and they don't work, the only way to achieve the object of the act is to enjoin a strike.
No, it does not say that there will be no strikes. And this court has held that at a certain point in time there can be strikes. We're not taking the position that there can't be. We're just saying that its principal purpose was to avoid that, if at all possible. Now, what this court clearly has held in a case that really isn't given the play that it ought to have been is this Florida East Coast case, which also says that even when you come to the exhaustion of those procedures vis-a-vis the primary employer, it's still not law of the jungle. You still have to look to see whether in light of the overall purposes of the Act, what the rules should be with respect to the party's rights of self-help after that point in time.
In our making common law, you would say you could still pick at interconnecting lines.
That gets to the tough case. And you'd have to look. You would borrow Justice White at that point. You would borrow from the related doctrines that this court has developed under the National Labor Relations Act, as the court has had so many times that it is proper to do. My time is up, Mr. Chief Justice.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. The case is submitted. We'll hear argument next in number 8.